April in Paris. This is the first story I ever got paid for, the second story I ever got published, and maybe the 30th or 40th story I wrote. I'd been writing poetry and fiction ever since my brother Ted, tired of having an illiterate 5-year-old sister around, taught me to read. At about 20, I began sending things off to publishers. Some of the poetry got printed, but I didn't get systematic about sending out the fiction till I was getting on to 30. It kept systematically coming back. April in Paris was the first genre piece, recognizably fantasy or science fiction, that I had written since 1942, when I wrote an Origin of Life on Earth story for Astounding, which for some inconceivable reason rejected it. I never did sync with John Campbell. At age 12, I was very pleased to get a genuine printed rejection slip, but by age 32, I was very pleased to get a check. Professionalism is no virtue. A professional is simply one who gets paid for doing what an amateur does for love. But in a money economy, the fact of being paid means your work is going to be circulated, is going to be read. It's the means to communication, which is the artist's goal. Seeley Goldsmith Lally, who bought this story in 1962, was as enterprising and perceptive an editor as the science fiction magazines have ever had, and I am grateful to her for opening the door to me. Professor Barry Pennywither sat in a cold, shadowy garret and stared at the table in front of him, on which lay a book and a bread crust. The bread had been his dinner. The book had been his life work. Both were dry. Dr. Pennywither sighed and then shivered. Though the lower-floor apartments of the old house were quite elegant, the heat was turned off on April 1st, come what may. It was now April 2nd, and sleeting. If Dr. Pennywither raised his head a little, he could see from his window the two square towers of Notre Dame de Paris, vague and soaring in the dusk, almost near enough to touch. For the island of Saint-Louis, where he lived, is like a little barge being towed downstream behind the island of the city where Notre Dame stands. But he did not raise his head. He was too cold. The great towers sank into darkness. Dr. Pennywither sank into gloom. He stared with loathing at his book. It had won him a year in Paris. Publish or perish, said the dean of faculties, and he had published, and been rewarded with a year's leave from teaching, without pay. Munson College could not afford to pay unteaching teachers. So, on his scraped-up savings, he had come back to Paris, to live again as a student in a garret, to read 15th-century manuscripts at the library, to see the chestnuts flower along the avenues. But it hadn't worked. He was 40, too old for lonely garrets. The sleet would blight the budding chestnut flowers, and he was sick of his work. Who cared about his theory, the Pennywither theory, concerning the mysterious disappearance of the poet François Villon in 1463? Nobody. For after all, his theory about poor Villon, the greatest juvenile delinquent of all time, was only a theory and could never be proved. Not across the gulf of 500 years. Nothing could be proved. And besides, what did it matter if Villon died on Montfaucon gallows or, as Pennywither thought, in a Lyon brothel on the way to Italy? Nobody cared. Nobody else loved Villon enough. Nobody loved Dr. Pennywither either. Not even Dr. Pennywither. Why should he? An unsocial, unmarried, underpaid pedant, sitting here alone in an unheated attic, in an unrestored tenement, trying to write another unreadable book. "I'm unrealistic," he said aloud with another sigh and another shiver. He got up and took the blanket off his bed, wrapped himself in it, sat down thus bundled at the table, and tried to light a Gauloise Bleu. His lighter snapped vainly. He sighed once more, got up, fetched a can of vile-smelling French lighter fluid, sat down, rewrapped his cocoon, filled the lighter, and snapped it. The fluid had spilled around a good bit. The lighter lit, so did Dr. Pennywither, from the wrists down. "Oh, hell!" he cried, blue flames leaping from his knuckles, and jumped up, batting his arms wildly, shouting, "Hell!" and raging against destiny. Nothing ever went right. What was the use? It was then 8:12 on the night of April 2nd, 1961. A man sat hunched at a table in a cold, high room. Through the window behind him, the two square towers of Notre Dame loomed in the spring dusk. In front of him on the table lay a hunk of cheese and a huge iron-latched handwritten book. The book was called, in Latin, On the Primacy of the Element Fire Over the Other Three Elements. Its author stared at it with loathing. Nearby, on a small iron stove, a small alembic simmered. Jean Lenoir mechanically inched his chair nearer the stove now and then for warmth, but his thoughts were on deeper problems.
"Hell," he said finally, in late medieval French, slammed the book shut and got up. What if his theory was wrong? What if water were the primal element? How could you prove these things? There must be some way, some method, so that one could be sure, absolutely sure, of one single fact. But each fact led into others. A monstrous tangle, and the authorities conflicted. And anyway, no one would read his book, not even the wretched pedants at the Sorbonne. They smelled heresy. Ah, what was the use? What good this life spent in poverty and alone, when he had learned nothing, merely guessed and theorized? He strode about the garret, raging, and then stood still. All right, he said to Destiny. Very good. You've given me nothing, so I'll take what I want.
He went to one of the stacks of books that covered most of the floor space, yanked out a bottom volume, scarring the leather and bruising his knuckles when the overlying folios avalanched, slapped it on the table and began to study one page of it. Then, still with a set cold look of rebellion, he got things ready. Sulphur, silver, chalk. Though the room was dusty and littered, his little workbench was neatly and handily arranged. He was soon ready. Then he paused.
"This is ridiculous," he muttered,
glancing out the window into the darkness, where now one could only guess at the two square towers. A watchman passed below, calling out the hour. 8 o'clock, of a cold, clear night. It was so still he could hear the lapping of the Seine. He shrugged, frowned, took up the chalk, and drew a neat pentagram on the floor near his table, then took up the book, and began to read in a clear but self-conscious voice.
Eri, heri, audi, me.
It was a long spell, and mostly nonsense. His voice sank. He stood bored and embarrassed. He hurried through the last words, shut the book, and then fell backwards against the door, gap-mouthed, staring at the enormous, shapeless figure that stood within the pentagram, lit only by the blue flicker of its waving, fiery claws. Barry Pennywither finally got control of himself and put out the fire by burying his hands in the folds of the blanket wrapped around him. Unburned, but upset, he sat down again. He looked at his book. Then he stared at it. It was no longer thin and gray and titled The Last Years of Villon, An Investigation of Possibilities. It was thick and brown and titled Incantatoria Magna. On his table? A priceless manuscript dating from 1407, of which the only extant undamaged copy was in the Ambrosian Library in Milan. He looked slowly around. His mouth dropped slowly open. He observed a stove, a chemist's workbench, two or three dozen heaps of unbelievable leather-bound books, the window, the door. His window, his door. But crouching against his door was a little creature, black and shapeless, from which came a dry, rattling sound. Barry Pennywither was not a very brave man, but he was rational. He thought he'd lost his mind, and so he said quite steadily, "Are you the devil?" The creature shuddered and rattled. Experimentally, with a glance at invisible Notre Dame, the professor made the sign of the cross. At this the creature twitched. Not a flinch, a twitch. Then it said something, feebly, but in perfectly good English. No, in perfectly good French. No, in rather odd French.
Mais vous êtes de Dieu, it said.
Barry got up and peered at it. Who are you? He demanded.
and it lifted up a quite human face and answered meekly, "Jean Lenoir." "What are you doing in my room?" There was a pause. Lenoir got up from his knees and stood straight, all 5'2" of him. "This is my room," he said at last, though very politely. Barry looked around at the books and alembics. There was another pause. "Then how did I get here?"
"I brought you."
"Are you a doctor?" Lenoir nodded with pride. His whole air had changed. "Yes, I'm a doctor," he said. "Yes, I brought you here. If nature will yield me no knowledge, then I can conquer nature herself. I can work a miracle." "To the devil with science, then. I was a scientist," he glared at Barry. "No longer. They call me a fool, a heretic. Well, by God, I'm worse. I'm a sorcerer, a black magician, Jean the Black.
Magic works, does it?
Then science is a waste of time." "Ha!" he said, but he did not really look triumphant. "I wish it hadn't worked," he said quietly, pacing up and down between folios.
"So do I," said the guest.
"Who are you?"
Lenoir looked up challengingly at Barry, though there was nearly a foot difference in their heights.
"Barry A. Pennywither. I'm a professor of French at Munson College, Indiana, on leave in Paris to pursue my studies of late medieval Fr—"
He stopped. He had just realized what kind of accent Lenoir had.
"What year is this? What century?"
"Please, Dr. Lenoir."
The Frenchman looked confused. The meanings of words change, as well as their pronunciations.
"Who rules this country?" Barry shouted.
Lenoir gave a shrug, a French shrug. Some things never change.
"Louis is king," he said. "Louis the 11th, the dirty old spider."
They stood staring at each other like wooden Indians for some time. Lenoir spoke first.
"Then you're a man?"
"Yes."
"Look, Lenoir, I think your spell, you must have muffed it a bit."
"Evidently," said the alchemist. "Are you French?"
"No."
"Are you English?" Lenoir glared. "Are you a filthy goddamn?"
"No, no, I'm from America. I'm from
your future.
From the 20th century A.D.
Barry blushed. It sounded silly, and he was a modest man, but he knew this was no illusion. The room he stood in, his room, was new, not 5 centuries old, unswept, but new, and the copy of Albertus Magnus by his knee was new, bound in soft, supple calfskin, the gold lettering gleaming. And there stood Lenoir in his black gown, not in costume, at home.
"Please sit down, sir,"
Lenoir was saying. And he added, with the fine, though absent courtesy of the poor scholar,
"Are you tired from the journey? I have bread and cheese, if you will honor me by sharing it."
They sat at the table munching bread and cheese. At first, Lenoir tried to explain why he had tried black magic.
"I was fed up," he said, "fed up. I've slaved in solitude since I was 20. For what? For knowledge. To learn some of nature's secrets. They're not to be learned."
He drove his knife 1/2 inch into the table, and Barry jumped. Lenoir was a thin little fellow, but evidently a passionate one. It was a fine face, though pale and lean, intelligent, alert, vivid. Barry was reminded of the face of a famous atomic physicist seen in newspaper pictures up until 1953. Somehow this likeness prompted him to say,
"Some are, Lenoir. We've learned a good bit here and there."
"What?" said the alchemist, skeptical but curious.
"Well, I'm no scientist. Can you make gold?"
He grinned as he asked.
"No, I don't think so. But they do make diamonds."
"How?"
"Carbon. Coal, you know. Under great heat and pressure, I believe. Coal and diamond are both carbon, you know, the same element."
"Element?"
"Now, as I say, I'm no—" "Which is the primal element?"
Lenoir shouted, his eyes fiery, the knife poised in his hand. "There are about 100 elements," Barry said coldly, hiding his alarm. 2 hours later, having squeezed out of Barry every dribble of the remnants of his college chemistry course, Lenoir rushed out into the night and reappeared shortly with a bottle.
"Oh, my master," he cried, "to think I offered you only bread and cheese."
It was a pleasant Burgundy, vintage 1477, a good year. After they had drunk a glass together, Lenoir said,
"If somehow I could repay you..."
"You can. Do you know the name of the poet, François Villon?"
"Yes,"
Lenoir said with some surprise.
"But he wrote only French trash, you know, not in Latin."
"Do you know how or when he died?"
"Oh, yes. Hanged at Montfaucon, here in 64 or 65, with a crew of no-goods like himself.
Why?" 2 hours later, the bottle was dry. Their throats were dry, and the watchman had called 3 o'clock of a clear, cold morning.
"Jean, I'm worn out," Barry said. "You'd better send me back."
The alchemist was too polite, too grateful, and perhaps also too tired to argue. Barry stood stiffly inside the pentagram, a tall, bony figure muffled in a brown blanket, smoking a Gauloise bleu.
"Adieu,"
Lenoir said sadly.
"Au revoir,"
Barry replied. Lenoir began to read the spell backwards. The candle flickered, his voice softened.
"Me audi, here, here,"
he read, sighed, and looked up. The pentagram was empty. The candle flickered.
"But I learn so little," Lenoir cried out to the empty room.
Then he beat the open book with his fists and said,
"And a friend like that, a real friend."
He smoked one of the cigarettes Barry had left him. He had taken to tobacco at once. He slept, sitting at his table, for a couple of hours. When he woke, he brooded a little, relit his candle, smoked the other cigarette, then opened the Incantatoria and began to read aloud.
"Here, here." "Oh, thank God,"
Barry said, stepping quickly out of the pentagram and grasping Lenoir's hand.
"Listen, I got back there, this room, this same room, Jean, but old, horribly old and empty. You weren't there. I thought, my God, what have I done? I'd sell my soul to get back there to him. What can I do with what I've learned? Who believe it? How can I prove it? And who the devil could I tell it to anyhow? Who cares?" I couldn't sleep. I sat and cried for an hour.
"Will you stay?"
"Yes, look.
I brought these in case you did invoke me." Sheepishly, he exhibited 8 packs of Gauloise, several books, and a gold watch.
"It might fetch a price," he explained. "I knew paper francs wouldn't do much good."
At sight of the printed books, Lenoir's eyes gleamed with curiosity, but he stood still.
"My friend," he said, "you said you'd sell your soul. You know, so would I. Yet we haven't. How, after all, how did this happen, that we're both men, no devils, no pacts in blood, 2 men who lived in this room?"
"I don't know," said Barry. "We'll think that out later. Can I stay with you, Jean?"
"Consider this your home," Lenoir said with a gracious gesture around the room, the stacks of books,
the alembics, the candle growing pale. Outside the window, gray on gray, rose up the 2 great towers of Notre Dame. It was the dawn of April 3rd. After breakfast, bread crusts and cheese rinds, they went out and climbed the South Tower. The cathedral looked the same as always, though cleaner than in 1961, but the view was rather a shock to Barry. He looked down upon a little town, 2 small islands covered with houses. On the right bank, more houses crowded inside a fortified wall. On the left bank, a few streets twisting around the college, and that was all. Pigeons chortled on the sun-warmed stone between gargoyles. Lenoir, who had seen the view before, was carving the date, in Roman numerals, on a parapet.
"Let's celebrate," he said. "Let's go out into the country. I haven't been out of the city for 2 years. Let's go clear over there.
He pointed to a misty green hill on which a few huts and a windmill were just visible.
Montmartre, eh? There are some good bars there, I'm told.
Their life soon settled into an easy routine. At first, Barry was a little nervous in the crowded streets, but in a spare black gown of Lenoir's, he was not noticed as outlandish except for his height. He was probably the tallest man in 15th-century France. Living standards were low, and lice were unavoidable, but Barry had never valued comfort much. The only thing he really missed was coffee at breakfast. When they had bought a bed and a razor, Barry had forgotten his, and introduced him to the landlord as Monsieur Berry, a cousin of Lenoir's from the Auvergne, their housekeeping arrangements were complete. Barry's watch brought a tremendous price, 4 gold pieces, enough to live on for a year. They sold it as a wondrous new timepiece from Illyria, and the buyer, a court chamberlain looking for a nice present to give the king, looked at the inscription, Hamilton Brothers, New Haven, 1881, and nodded sagely. Unfortunately, he was shut up in one of King Louis's cages for naughty courtiers at Tours before he had presented his gift, and the watch may still be there behind some brick in the ruins of Plessis, but this did not affect the two scholars. Mornings they wandered about sightseeing the Bastille and the churches, or visiting various minor poets in whom Barry was interested. After lunch they discussed electricity, the atomic theory, physiology, and other matters in which Lenoir was interested, and performed minor chemical and anatomical experiments, usually unsuccessfully. After supper they merely talked. Endless, easy talks that ranged over the centuries, but always ended here, in the shadowy room with its window open to the spring night, in their friendship. After 2 weeks they might have known each other all their lives. They were perfectly happy. They knew they would do nothing with what they had learned from each other. In 1961, how could Barry ever prove his knowledge of old Paris? In 1482, how could Lenoir ever prove the validity of the scientific method? It did not bother them. They had never really expected to be listened to. They had merely wanted to learn. So they were happy for the first time in their lives. So happy, in fact, that certain desires, always before subjugated to the desire for knowledge, began to awaken. "I don't suppose," Barry said one night across the table, "that you ever thought much about marrying."
"Well, no," his friend answered doubtfully. "That is, I'm in minor orders, and it seemed irrelevant and expensive. Besides, in my time, no self-respecting woman would want to share my kind of life. American women are so damn poised and efficient and glamorous, terrifying creatures. And women here are little and dark, like beetles, with bad teeth," Lenoir said morosely.
They said no more about women that night, but the next night they did, and the next. And on the next, celebrating the successful dissection of the main nervous system of a pregnant frog, they drank 2 bottles of Montrachet 74 and got soused.
"Let's invoke a woman, Jean," Barry said in a lascivious bass, grinning like a gargoyle. "What if I raised a devil this time?
Is there really much difference?" They laughed wildly and drew a pentagram.
"Here, here," Lenoir began.
When he got the hiccups, Barry took over. He read the last words. There was a rush of cold, marshy-smelling air, and in the pentagram stood a wild-eyed being with long black hair, stark naked, screaming.
"Woman, by God," said Barry. "Is it?"
It was.
"Here, take my cloak," Barry said, for the poor thing now stood gawping and shivering.
He put the cloak over her shoulders. Mechanically she pulled it round her, muttering,
"Gratias ago, Domine." "Latin!" Lenoir shouted. "A woman speaking Latin?"
It took him longer to get over that shock than it did Bota to get over hers. She was, it seemed, a slave in the household of the sub-prefect of North Gaul, who lived on the smaller island of the muddy island town called Lutetia. She spoke Latin with a thick Celtic brogue, and did not even know who was emperor in Rome in her day.
"A real barbarian," Lenoir said with scorn.
So she was, an ignorant, taciturn, humble barbarian with tangled hair, white skin, and clear gray eyes. She had been waked from a sound sleep. When they convinced her that she was not dreaming, she evidently assumed that this was some prank of her foreign and all-powerful master, the sub-prefect, and accepted the situation without further question.
"Am I to serve you, my masters?" she inquired timidly, but without sullenness, looking from one to the other.
"Not me," Lenoir growled, and added in French to Barry, "Go on. I'll sleep in the storeroom."
He departed. Bota looked up at Barry. No Gauls and few Romans were so magnificently tall. No Gauls and no Romans ever spoke so kindly.
"Your lamp,"
it was a candle, but she had never seen a candle,
"is nearly burnt out," she said. "Shall I blow it out?"
For an additional 2 sols a year, the landlord let them use the storeroom as a second bedroom, and Lenoir now slept alone again in the main room of the garret. He observed his friend's idol with a brooding, unjealous interest. The professor and the slave girl loved each other with delight and tenderness. Their pleasure overlapped Lenoir in waves of protective joy. Bota had led a brutal life, treated always as a woman, but never as a human. In 1 short week she bloomed, she came alive, evincing beneath her gentle passiveness a tearful, clever nature.
"You're turning out a regular Parisienne," he heard Barry accuse her one night. The attic walls were thin.
She replied, "If you knew what it is for me not to be always defending myself, always afraid, always alone."
Lenoir sat up on his cot and brooded. About midnight, when all was quiet, he rose and noiselessly prepared the pinches of sulphur and silver, drew the pentagram, opened the book. Very softly he read the spell. His face was apprehensive. In the pentagram appeared a small white dog. It cowered and hung its tail, then came shyly forward, sniffed Lenoir's hand, looked up at him with liquid eyes, and gave a modest, pleading whine. A lost puppy. Lenoir stroked it. It licked his hands and jumped all over him, wild with relief. On its white leather collar was a silver plaque engraved, "Joli, Dupont, 36 Rue du Seine, Paris, 6e." Joli went to sleep, after gnawing a crust, curled up under Lenoir's chair. And the alchemist opened the book again and read, still softly, but this time without self-consciousness, without fear, knowing what would happen. Emerging from his storeroom-bedroom honeymoon in the morning, Barry stopped short in the doorway. Lenoir was sitting up in bed, petting a white puppy, and deep in conversation with the person sitting on the foot of the bed, a tall, red-haired woman dressed in silver. The puppy barked. Lenoir said, "Good morning." The woman smiled wondrously.
"Jumping Jesus," Barry muttered in English.
Then he said, "Good morning. When are you from?" The effect was Rita Hayworth, sublimated. Hayworth plus the Mona Lisa, perhaps?
"From Altair, about 7,000 years from now," she said, smiling still more wondrously.
Her French accent was worse than that of a football scholarship freshman.
"I'm an archaeologist. I was excavating the ruins of Paris III. I'm sorry I speak the language so badly. Of course, we know it only from inscriptions." "From Altair, the star? But you're human, I think. Our planet was colonized from Earth about 4,000 years ago. That is, 3,000 years from now." She laughed most wondrously and glanced at Lenoir.
"Jean explained it all to me, but I still get confused."
"It was a dangerous thing to try it again, Jean," Barry accused him. "We've been awfully lucky, you know."
"No," said the Frenchman, "not lucky."
"But after all, it's black magic you're playing with. Listen, I don't know your name, madam."
"Kisulk," she said.
"Listen, Kisulk," Barry said, without even a stumble. "Your science must be fantastically advanced. Is there any magic? Does it exist? Can the laws of nature really be broken, as we seem to be doing?"
"I've never seen nor heard of an authenticated case of magic."
"Then what goes on?" Barry roared. "Why does that stupid old spell work for Jean, for us, that one spell, and here, nowhere else, for nobody else, in 15,000 years of recorded history? Why? Why? And where did that damn puppy come from?"
"The puppy was lost," Lenoir said, his dark face grave. "Somewhere near this house,
on the Ile Saint-Louis.
And I was sorting potsherds, Kissel said also gravely, in a house site, Island 2, Pit 4, Section D. A lovely spring day, and I hated it. Loathed it. The day, the work, the people around me. Again she looked at the gaunt little alchemist, a long, quiet look. I tried to explain it to Jean last night. We've improved the race, you see. We're all very tall, healthy, and beautiful. No fillings in our teeth. All skulls from early America have fillings in the teeth. Some of us are brown, some white, some gold-skinned, but all beautiful and healthy and well-adjusted and aggressive and successful. Our professions and degree of success are pre-planned for us in the state preschool homes. But there's an occasional genetic flaw. Me, for instance. I was trained as an archaeologist because the teachers saw that I really didn't like people, live people. People bored me. All like me on the outside, all alien to me on the inside. When everything's alike, which place is home? But now I've seen an unhygienic room with insufficient heating. Now I've seen a cathedral not in ruins. Now I've met a living man who's shorter than me, with bad teeth and a short temper. Now I'm home. I'm where I can be myself. I'm no longer alone.
Alone, Lenoir said gently to Barry.
Loneliness, eh?
Loneliness is the spell. Loneliness is stronger.
Really, it doesn't seem unnatural.
Bodo was peering round the doorway, her face flushed between the black tangles of her hair. She smiled shyly and said a polite Latin good morning to the newcomer.
Kissel doesn't know Latin, Lenoir said with immense satisfaction. We must teach Bodo some French. French is the language of love anyway, eh? Come along. Let's go out and buy some bread. I'm hungry.
Kissel hid her silver tunic under the useful and anonymous cloak, while Lenoir pulled on his moth-eaten black gown. Bodo combed her hair, while Barry thoughtfully scratched a louse bite on his neck. Then they set forth to get breakfast. The alchemist and the interstellar archaeologist went first, speaking French. The Gaulish slave and the professor from Indiana followed, speaking Latin and holding hands. The narrow streets were crowded, bright with sunshine. Above them, Notre Dame reared its two square towers against the sky. Beside them, the Seine rippled softly. It was April in Paris, and on the banks of the river, the chestnuts were in bloom.